The big sick. I'm pretty sure that's what we agreed on.
Oh, fuck.
You accidentally saw Annabelle 2 instead?
Yeah, no, that's what I saw.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again, Keith Foster, San Diego, co-host, you are it.
With me is Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California.
I am that guy.
Woo! And I thought the end times were last week. You know, it's scary out there. That's all I have to say about things. Did I bring it down at the beginning of the show?
Always. Yeah, I try and keep us up. I come in strong with the big loud opening just to kind of rev me into the episode, and then you're like, by the way, world sucks again. It hasn't stopped sucking.
No. In fact, it somehow keeps managing to get worse. Uh-huh. Not only are we on the brink of nuclear war, the Nazis are back.
Just when you thought they were done.
Here's the thing. Nazis in 2017. I know a lot of people have hot takes on Nazis right now.
Right.
I do think it's kind of ironic, especially what our Netflix homework was last week.
Oh my God. Can you, like, I was going to text you that. Like, people haven't listened to our last episode, we did a documentary all about the KKK and like, you know, converting people from racism. And then literally, like, 2 days later, all this Nazi business is in the news.
Yeah. So go check out our last episode and listen, and check out the movie, Accidental Courtesy.
Yes.
More relevant now than ever. But
super topical.
But yeah, so my feeling on Nazis in 2017, you know, despite all the obvious feelings about them being garbage and having no place in this world, is that they're sort of like the Joker in movies. Like, you know, there are other Batman villains.
Mm-hmm.
Nazis in World War II were sort of like Jack Nicholson in the original Batman.
Oh, man. Okay, keep going.
Nazis in 2017 are Jared Leto's awful, not scary, tatted up, gross
Juggalo
thing that you're like, what are you even doing in this movie?
Right.
That was all the analogy. It was just sort of an opportunity to shit on Jared Leto.
I got that, yeah. That could be workshopped, that bit you had going on there.
Yeah.
It's not done.
No.
But yeah, no, I know what you're trying to say. It's kind of crazy because, like, it's sort of, whenever, like, this kind of stuff's going on at work, it's always, like, the elephant in the room. Well, especially during the time of, like, the election and stuff. Like, I mean, we work in a fairly public setting. So even though most people are politically aligned, here in West LA, there are people who aren't, and we have to.
There's actually a lot of hate groups in sort of the Los Angeles area, more than I realize. And I mean, that's, you know, that comes from larger populations. But I just saw, like, a Facebook event for a fucking book burning in Huntington Beach.
Well, Orange County in general is skews conservative.
Yeah,
because it's, you know, largely affluent and white, and yeah, so there are large pockets of conservatism in Orange County. That's
it. Just surprises me because, you know, here I thought we were living in Woke-a-fornia.
I mean, no, not really.
I know,
and San Diego is fairly conservative too because it's a big military city.
Yeah, but it, yes and no, because a lot of the military, you know, they don't support that sort of thing, but they're, the more sort of east you go, it kind of gets there. Like, there's a town, the town I used to live in called Santee, which was nicknamed Clantee. And, you know, I just thought it was kind of like a silly nickname.
Right.
No, I mean, there's some serious hate group there. Like,
no, if you go out up into Bakersfield and that area, there's like, the large KKK membership, like it's everywhere.
It's like
Oregon is like you know, everyone thinks of like Portlandia and like the super hipsters and the fixed gear bike people, but there's out in the woods, you just go a few miles and it's a whole different story.
Can we just not
go into this at all?
No, just like not with the white supremacy, not with the Nazis. Like, could we just not like?
I would like.
I don't have the energy for this bullshit. I got other stuff going on in my life.
I'm not into it.
Yeah.
It's not my favorite thing.
No, it shouldn't be. Shouldn't be anybody's. No. If it is your favorite thing, reevaluate.
Yeah.
Take a minute. Think about what you're really mad about, and maybe just stop.
Stop with all that.
Yeah, just like breathe a breath and be like, whew, man, I was awful. But today's a new day, moving forward.
Right. I'm sure that'll help. Today we're going to be reviewing some movies. We're going to be reviewing The Big Sick. We're catching up with. It's been out for a little while, but both of us had some interest in seeing it. It was still in theaters. I'm not sure for how much longer, but it's still in theaters. Actually, it's been in theaters almost all summer. It's for an independent movie. It's done very, very well.
Yeah.
And at the end of the episode, we're going to review in our Netflix homework, Sunset Boulevard, classic 1950 film, which I had you watch.
Yeah.
But we do have some movie news, a little bit of movie news.
Movie news. Talking about that movie news.
When it rains, it pours.
Right now it is not raining or pouring. The movie news. Lots of news about Nazis, not so much about movies. Let's see how interested you are in this. License to Drive. There's going to be a remake of the movie License to Drive, the 1988 comedy starring Corey Haim and Corey Feldman. And I guess Heather Graham was in that. I didn't know that. I've never actually seen License to Drive. I've only seen one Corey project, and that is The Lost Boys, or in which they were in the movie together. I've seen a lot of Corey Feldman movies, obviously.
But you haven't seen a lot of
Corey movies. No. So, you know, without getting super dark and super depressing into the story of the Coreys, what do you think about this idea of trying to remake this old movie?
I have literally never even heard of it before, so I'm not, attached.
I remember specifically, this might be a your bad memory story, but that's I remember specifically you, saw this as a trailer in front of a DVD or video that you had a long time ago, and you were like, oh my god, you have to watch this trailer, it's so funny. Like, this is like, we were like maybe 21 or something.
No.
Yes.
Why did I think it was funny?
I don't know, because it was like kitschy in 80s and it had the Coreys in it.
No, I don't think so.
This was a thing.
That doesn't sound like my thing. That doesn't sound like I'd be like, oh my god, check out this trailer for this movie from the 80s. It's like retro.
I don't know what accent or character you're doing right now.
That was 80s accent.
That's exactly how you sounded when you were 21 when you did do this. Okay.
Oh my god, we can drink now.
So, yeah, the plot of this movie, do you really care?
I literally don't think I've heard of this.
A teen, after failing his driver's test, decides to go for a night on the town with his friends. He takes his grandfather's prized 72 Cadillac sedan to Ville out on a joyride, which leads to all sorts of shenanigans and trouble, blah, blah, blah. Essentially, it sounds like it was maybe like a kind of a post-Ferris Bueller sort of thing.
Uh-huh. I mean, it sounds exactly like the plot of Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Right. So, here I'm okay. Here's the thing. This is going to be terrible. Like, obviously, like, nobody cares enough that they're just going to shoot this out there. They're not going to do anything with it. It's going to come and go. It might not even make it to theaters, which makes this new segment totally useless.
Yeah, but I don't understand what the point of it is.
I was looking for news stories, and this was one of them. but my only hot take on it is this, to me, is the type of stuff they should be remaking. If we're going to go out and remake old movies, let's remake the ones that didn't matter. Let's remake the ones that were...
Yeah.
Could use an update. Or, like, you could just take the framework of the idea and maybe do something cool with it.
But here's the thing. Like, why do a remake of this movie, like, nobody gives a shit about? Like, you're not banking on the name recognition of fucking License to Drive.
Or even the Corys.
Like, that money could go to budget, you know, like, an original screenplay that, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I just don't get it. To me, it just...
Let's say you're an ambitious 31-year-old. You're living in Hollywood.
Okay. So far, we're pretty close to home. I am a 31-year-old. Yeah. I'm not super ambitious. I should be better about that.
Vaguely ambitious. You're trying to get your foot in the door. You have, you know, a stack of spec scripts that you're hoping to sell someday.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden...
One would not be licensed to drive.
Well, all of a sudden, a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend who once knew a producer who was an assistant director on a movie that nobody saw anyway, is working on the License to Drive project, and he's looking for a writer, and you get the assignment. The assignment
to put
your take, the modern take,
I'm not, like, putting the writer of this on blast. It's more the producers.
That's not where I'm going with this. I'm just saying, if the what-if scenario that you had to update License to Drive from where you're standing right now, you have nothing to lose. You are literally the opposite of famous in most every way.
Thanks.
If you were to give in this assignment, just to get your foot in the door, you know this movie's going to get made.
Mm-hmm.
You've never seen the original movie, but wouldn't you think that, like, this is like a loose enough whatever that you could do just about anything with it?
Sure, yeah.
You could make a great film out of this ridiculous plot.
Yeah,
it doesn't have to suck.
I would 100% take the assignment.
Right.
Like, 1,000%. No, I get that. I just... Mm-hmm. I don't get the producer who's like, what do we got? Let's reboot this obscure Corey movie nobody's heard of from the 80s without the Coreys. The only thing that this movie was banking on when it came out in the first place. Like, I just...
right.
Yeah, I don't understand that.
I think Corey Feldman will make an appearance.
Probably. That's not my point at all. My point is... Who is asking for this movie?
Oh, nobody.
Well, apparently someone at Fox is.
Mm-hmm. Next story.
The Deadpool director, director of Deadpool 1, mm-hmm. Tim Miller is going to be directing an adaptation of the cyberpunk novel Neuromancer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. How do you feel about this? I'm not familiar really with Neuromancer. I think I've heard of it just because, I got into kind of like the various types of punk, like steampunk and cyberpunk. Mm. And I think it's one of those ones that the name gets around, but I don't really know much
about it. It's not as big as like a Philip K. Dick kind of thing, but it's, but yeah, I think it was during that time, the height of like the cyberpunk thing in the 80s. I have no attachment to the source material. I imagine there are people who probably do. I think it is something... I think I've heard of the novel, and I think that I've heard them trying to adapt it more than once. Like, I think this has kind of been in development for a while.
Yeah, like it sounds familiar, but I guess just like this is Tim Miller's next project. What do you think about that?
What did Tim Miller do before Deadpool? Was there a Tim Miller before Deadpool?
I don't think so.
I'm going to look up real fast.
I know. He did the test footage for Deadpool.
Right, that little short that kind of got the movie made.
Yeah.
So he only has 4 directing credits. Deadpool's his first feature. He did a couple shorts, Rockfish and Aunt Louisa. And then there's slated a Terminator reboot, which we'll see if that even happens.
Uh-huh.
I think, you know, Deadpool is, people really love that Deadpool movie. And inexplicably so. Like, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a cool little superhero satire. I didn't think it was, like, the end-all be-all of all, you know, violent action movie whatever.
I feel like I've seen better. I don't know. Not better. I liked it.
The movie was what it needed to be and almost nothing more.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think people who are super familiar with the character and, you know Deadpool and have been waiting for the movie for a while probably feel fairly similar. I think people who were really taken with it are people who only really know of Deadpool because of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't come away from the movie thinking like, oh, here's a visionary. It'd be interesting to see him work, just to see another movie by him that isn't Deadpool related, just so I can get a better idea of who he is as a director. Like, what is his thing?
Especially with all the sort of controversy about Deadpool 2, and him, you know, like how his vision differed from Ryan Reynolds and like,
oh yeah, all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm interested to sort of see what his sort of style is. Because
I mean, Deadpool has a style, but it's rooted in the tropes of the comic and the character. Yeah. That I wonder, is that stuff he would have done on his own? I don't know.
Yeah, like it doesn't necessarily feel directorial. It feels like he wants to be true to the character.
Right.
So, in a lot of ways, I feel like Deadpool's actually a pretty conventional superhero movie. Mm. Like, it's got some great jokes and some fun meta stuff.
Yeah.
But if you really look at, like, just the story...
It's an origin movie.
It's pretty by-the-numbers origin.
Yeah, and I mean, it breaks up the timeline in an interesting way, and it's certainly filthy, but, you know, and it's pretty much... It's not too far off from, like, Spider-Man 1.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, if, you know, very self-aware, but... Mm. Yeah, especially, like, once we get to sort of the third act, and it becomes... A pretty conventional superhero movie.
For sure, yeah. Deadpool, but yeah, I think... I'm interested to see what a Tim Miller movie looks like outside of the world of Deadpool.
Yeah.
Also, I'm interested... is Cyberpunk coming back? You know, Hollywood really wants it to. I'm not so sure that anybody else wants it to. Because Ghost in the Shell remake did not do that well. And for the most part, people are fairly negative on it.
We'll kind of see with Blade Runner.
I think that's really going to see. I think, this movie happening is going to totally hinge on the success or failure of Blade Runner.
Yeah. I can believe that. It's early enough in production that,
right.
If they have to, they could move on.
Right.
Plus, I think Tim Miller might also have like 2 or 3 other projects sort of in the works. He also did test footage for the Goon movie that they did to launch their Kickstarter, which I totally subscribe to, and I totally have an awesome Goon movie poster signed by Eric Powell and Tim Miller and David Fincher and all of the people who've been involved in that. So I guess to me, I'm like, I just want that to happen. And, you know, maybe if he has another hit under his belt, that makes it more likely.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just want that to finally happen more than any.
Yeah, totally. Okay. Last story before we move on to the reviews. Dear White People team reunites on Justin Simien directed Bad Hair. Reading this on Deadline Hollywood. So Justin Simien was the writer director of the film Dear White People,
mm-hmm.
which he went to my school, not while I was there, but he graduated from Chapman and
I was gonna say he was not a Century High School alumni.
No, he wasn't. But he came back and he actually showed the film to Chapman before it came out officially in theaters. And I was a big fan of that movie. It ended up being in my top 10 at the end of the year. I think it's a really, really smart comedy. And again, also super relevant to today and stuff. And I haven't watched a TV show yet, but I'm interested. But yeah, so he's coming back with this movie. This is going to be a horror film. I heard some, where did I hear this? I heard somewhere, I think this was, I watched a video interview with Todd McFarlane about that whole Spawn reboot.
Uh-huh.
And somebody was asking him about it, and he said the buzz right now in Hollywood is everyone's looking for their next Get Out, which is a small horror film that's going to have big returns.
Yeah.
And so this might be involved with that sort of push, why he gets to make this movie. But it says here, paralleling the rise of the New Jack Swing in 1989, Bad Hair is a horror satire that follows an ambitious young woman who gets a weave in order to survive the image-obsessed world of music television. Her professional success comes at a higher cost than anticipated, however, when she discovers her new hair might have a mind of its own. So
it's all right.
Obviously silly. On paper, that sounds borderline bad, but...
I mean, it could be sort of campy, fun. Like, it actually kind of sounds like Idle Hands,
mm-hmm.
but with, like, a weave.
Right. Coming from him, I trust it. Because I don't know if... Did you see Dear White People?
I did not. I haven't.
You should. I mean, again, I can't vouch for the TV show. I haven't watched it. I'm interested. But the movie, I thought it was really, really smart. It's like it's like the best parts of early Spike Lee and Wes Anderson, like the meeting of the two.
Okay. Like
Rushmore era, Wes Anderson meets Do the Right Thing. And I think, you know, it's super nuanced and it comes up with a lot of different interesting arguments. He's really good at writing characters. I can see why it became a TV show because when I walked away from that movie, I was like, God, you could like keep telling the story of a lot of these kids. There's so much going on there. So I, you know, if he can bring that sort of nuance and likability to, you know, what is essentially sounds like a pretty silly horror movie premise.
Sure.
I'm interested, and especially if it has kind of a racial specificity going on here. It takes place in 1989. That's cool, too.
Here's the thing. No matter what, I am all for more people, more black people getting more jobs. There is a huge white male bias in Hollywood to...
Ooh.
As directors, and the more we can sort of break out from that, the more I'm for it. So even not having seen Dear White People, like just, you know, the plot synopsis you read me sounds a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I loved Get Out. It's one of my favorite movies of the year so far. So I also like that is sort of inspiring. I think it's great that Get Out has inspired Hollywood to air quotes, take chances and air quotes, you know, on more movies sort of in that vein. I think it's sort of not really fair until, you know, black people and just people of color in general and women, have the chance to make just as many shitty movies as white men do.
Fair enough. Yes, I agree with especially the sentiment that you lay out there. I'm not interested in tokenism, and yes. I think that there is some people can see this argument of the thing that you're talking about as being like, well, now we have to like, you know, set forth some sort of affirmative action program on Hollywood so that every single race gets every single, you know, chance to make whatever kind of movie they want to make, which is cool. I'm fine with that. Mm-hmm. I always want the precedent to be good movies. And I think we get closer to making good movies by making specific movies. And that's a problem with, even though Hollywood on a large scale isn't necessarily that it's not diverse enough, it's that it's not specific enough. They're trying to, they homogenize storytelling to try and sell to as many foreign markets as possible. And the unfortunately, the truth of it is, if you try and tell a specific story about, like, 1989 Black Southern culture, that doesn't travel to China. Mm-hmm. And so they purposely don't greenlight movies like that. Do you remember, I can't remember the director now. The guy who made Black Snake Moan and Hustle and Flow.
Uh-huh.
Brewers. Craig Brewer, I think was his name. He, two big indie hits. He told his movies and, you know, very Southern, very African-American oriented, white dude, but he's from that area. He made the movies he wanted to make. He had another movie about the South that he was going to make called Mother Trucker, and it ended up never getting greenlit for that exact reason. It doesn't go to China. The further we move away from that sort of homogeny, I think better and they get more specific, and storytelling gets closer to being about something rather than, you know, big spectacle or whatever.
Yeah. Well, my point is that movies don't always work. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you could have the right director, the right script, and the right actors, and for some reason it just, you know, falls apart in editing or whatever.
Right.
And it's unfortunate that right now it feels like most movies, most directors, most whatever, studios, whoever you want to blame, either aren't willing or aren't given the chance to take risks.
Right.
I would rather see a movie that takes bold risks like this, you know, about what sounds like horror hair in 1980s, than the same old safe garbage. It's only through experimentation that we know what's good and bad. So
right. Outside of the niches of like, oh, well, this is a Tyler Perry thing. Or it's going to play to this crowd and it's going to open this kind of weekend and blah, blah, blah.
Like, exactly.
Like a movie like Get Out, which, you know, played wide and was very successful, was very specific at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think a lot of that has to do with just, you know, being a good filmmaker and writing an interesting movie that can that has a universal appeal. And I've heard somebody say this before, and I tend to agree, that when you tell one person's story, you end up telling everybody's story because universality sort of lives in the specifics.
I get that. So before we move on, I actually just saw breaking news. It's, I don't know how much you'll care about this, so I'll get your hot take on it.
You're the one who wants to go to bed early. What is it?
Daniel Craig just confirmed that he will return as James Bond in November 2019.
Mm-hmm. I did see that. I didn't include it into the movie news. The only reason I didn't know what there was to really say about that other than, okay.
Well, it's
you
just,
know, there's been, he's done it four times now. He made a big to-do about not doing it anymore.
And a lot of people think that he had a pretty lukewarm reception to Spectre, and a lot of people's criticism were that he was kind of phoning it in, because at the time he was very vocal about
not being
not caring about the character anymore, not wanting to do it, and I actually. Didn't think his performance was bad in Spectre. I think there was other issues with that movie.
Right.
I don't know. I was just wondering if you had a take on him continuing as Bond, or if it's time to get someone new, Idris Elba, or not.
No, you know, I really don't super care. I think that the franchise could use some new blood. Like, I'm kind of a little over Craig as Bond. I think Craig is over Craig as Bond, clearly. Yeah. And
that's it's
four,
like,
movies. I felt like he's had his era. Mm-hmm. It feels kind of done, but we'll see. I mean, if, you know, if they try and correct the problems with Spectre, Spectre's main problem was just it was just a little all over the place and unstructured. I didn't think that it was. I didn't think it was as bad as some people made it out to be. There are certainly in the you know the grand scheme of things, there's been much worse Bond movies.
Yeah, Quantum of Solace.
Yeah, I mean even much worse Daniel Craig Bond movies.
I think most people universally kind of agree that Quantum of Solace is one of the worst Bond movies. Period.
Yeah, I mean that's generally the idea. But yeah, I don't care, really. I mean, if he wants to do it again, cool. I'm actually, at this point, I'm more interested to see, like, who's going to come in as director. They're going to bring back Sam Mendes. I'm more interested in who's going to be writing it. You know, that kind of stuff.
Okay. All right. Moving on.
Cool. Movie reviews. I feel like this is going to circle back a lot to our discussion we had of Justin Simien and cultural specificity. Let's talk about The Big Sick. This is the end of the summer. And usually towards the end of the summer is when you see all of the movie blogs and trades start to write their, is this the worst summer for Blockbuster articles? Because Blockbuster fatigue starts to set in.
Here's the thing. I actually think that this summer... has been way better than last year.
Yeah, last year was a turd.
Yeah,
For movies in general. I mean, I have my top 10. I like the movies that I liked, but it was scant.
Whereas this year, I feel like the problem is exactly that. It's fatigue.
The only reason I brought it up is because you know it's that time of the year. We are gonna review a smaller movie, an indie film. And like Baby Driver, even like Get Out, which you talked about earlier, this movie's been very successful. Why don't you go ahead and give me the premise of Michael Showalter directed this, The Big Sick.
Yeah, so this is a semi, but largely autobiographical story about stand-up comedian, Pakistan-born Kumail Nanjiani. He's gotten pretty big in the stand-up world now. He does a lot of stuff over at like Nerdist and Hollywood.
I think most people probably know him from Silicon Valley on HBO.
Yeah, he's also guested on Portlandia. That was where I first saw him. Mm-hmm. He's done a lot of cameos and stuff. Anyway, this is a semi-autobiographical movie about how he met and fell in love with his future wife, Emily Gordon, and how they're dating, they fall in love, and then they break up a lot, largely because of Kumail's family pressure to be in an arranged marriage to another Pakistani, a Pakistani woman, and then after the breakup, she gets very sick. She has a strange infection that the doctors can't figure out what's going on. And then her parents come, and he gets to know her parents after they've broken up. And then it goes from there.
Yeah, you know, I think that I don't know if I actually ever saw a full trailer of this. I sort of knew what it was about. I knew that it was sort of a semi-fictionalized version of their coming together.
And I mean semi-fictionalized, like, it's pretty much their story. Like, you know, they make it a movie, but, you know, the events are true. It's
follow
just, you
as,
know.
As, I guess, happened.
Yeah.
Certain things, like the comedians he was coming up with and stuff like that were probably added later.
Sure.
Or facsimiles of people he maybe knew when he lived in Chicago.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the timeline is played with a little bit, too, because this feels like it's set now.
Right now. Yeah, the references they're making, the technology they're using, it doesn't feel like whatever it would have been 2006 or 7 or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I was glad that I didn't know so much going in, because this movie does take a lot of wild turns. And it's a romantic comedy, I guess, but it is one that definitely follows its own structure. It definitely follows its own rules. And This is produced by Judd Apatow's company, Apatow Films. Mm-hmm. And it has a little bit of that rough around the edges, sort of unstructured, undisciplined Apatow-ness to it that I think sometimes hurts, sometimes helps what's going on here. Mm-hmm. But largely what I came away with is this is one of the most interesting romantic comedies I've seen because it's not necessarily a romantic comedy about a man falling in love with a woman so much as a man falling in love with his woman's parents. The real love story here, the big arc, it isn't necessarily between him and Emily, but it's between him and Holly Hunter and Ray Romano who play
her parents. Well, yeah, it's about him. It's about family. It's about, you know, like, mm-hmm. When you get married, you're not just marrying the person you love. You're marrying into a family.
Yes.
And that's not something that really gets talked about a lot in movies or really in popular culture. You know, there's a lot of like stereotypical in-law jokes.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of glossed over, but you know, it really does become a big part of your life.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I'm married and I know everything about it. So I definitely thought that was an interesting approach because it's about how like you said, is falling in love with her parents. It's also about how he chooses to sort of be his own man and willingly distance himself from his parents, which wants him to live a very traditional Pakistani culture.
There's a little bit of like a coming out story here. Not in an LGBT way, but there is a coming out story here where he has to tell his parents, I'm no longer a practicing Muslim. I no longer am looking for an arranged marriage, and there is the fear of being ostracized from his whole family. Mm-hmm. And I think that you know, the way that and he's keeping a love a secret. And so there is a lot of weird parallels to those films that do come out of like the LGBT film world the stereotypical coming out story. But the way that
I think it's also kind of a coming of age story in a way.
Certainly,
like 100%, I think everyone has definitely not to compare or to the struggle of LGBT issues,
or this kind of issue.
Yeah, but I think everybody can relate to the idea of living a different life than your parents are aware of. Being a different person around, say, even if it's as simple as being a different person around your friends and coworkers than you are your family, everyone has
a version of that. Well, kind of goes back to that idea of, like, the more specific your storytelling is, the more universal it becomes.
Oh, Jesus. If we want to talk about that, me and my wife Ashley were talking about how, like, it was sort of insane how much I was able to relate to Kumail, because I am a very different person. I live a very different life. I grew up as a non-denominational Christian in Southeast Idaho. Like I don't even think I knew, you know, what a Pakistani or a Muslim was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
But I could still completely relate to him. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was the other things that I found in common, like I am a comedian. His roommate, oh my God, his roommate played by, Kurt Braunohler.
Mm-hmm.
I played his roommate, Chris, reminded me so much of my roommate after you, Stephen.
Yeah. I met him a couple times.
He's a very nice guy. I'm sure he'll listen to this. I love you, Stephen, but you know who you are. That's okay. I love you for it. But he reminded me so much of my roommate.
Mm-hmm.
And even her parents, like Ray Romano, reminded me so much of my father-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of wigged me out.
Oh.
And even her mom, played by Holly Hunter, also kind of reminded me of my mother-in-law. Not as much as Ray Romano did my father-in-law. But, like, so there was a lot that I could connect with, even though this isn't my story.
Right. And I think that even, like, you know, the idea of, like, Kumail's family who have these very specific ideas of how they want him to come up and how he's supposed to fit into their world. I'm sure there's some cross parallel stuff there for just about anybody.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that's definitely the strength of the movie is the characters are so specific and charming and endearing, and it feels real. You know, because this could be a very high concept, high premise.
There's a version of this movie. You could do the sitcom version of this movie and you can make shtick out of all of these kind of fish out of water ideas or like the in-laws and da da da. There's a lot of places in this movie where you think it's going to become that movie and then it doesn't.
Which is a good thing.
Yes.
It could have played it very broadly, the whole thing just felt down to, you know, and I think Michael Showalter did a really good job, because he did talk about how this is an Apatow production and how sometimes those can be a little bloated. I think Michael Showalter showed a little bit more restraint. I think it does meander a little bit in the way that, you know, sort of true life stories do. But to me, it felt a little more restrained and a little less broad than Judd Apatow can sometimes be. And that was really working for me.
Yeah. The movie takes a couple big risks, I think. And one of them being the general premise of, okay, we're going to have the meet cute. It's going to start out like a traditional romantic comedy. And then one of your main characters is gone for half the movie, essentially.
Yeah.
And then the movie takes a pretty big left turn there, and it takes a huge risk with the audience. How interested are you in this whole story now that you don't have the love story to hang on to? Now you're dealing with this whole other situation. That's a pretty big risk, and I don't know if the movie always lands that risk as well as it thinks it is. I think ultimately I come around to it because I become invested in the new situation enough. I got there, but there was a moment where I was sort of in free fall, and I had to sort of trust the movie to make sure that all this stuff fits together.
Yeah, but that's interesting that you say that because they put a lot of – the movie sort of puts a lot of pressure on Ray Romano and Holly Hunter's performances because they do come in so late.
And they're so good. Like, that's one of those – it's the type of situation and the type of roles that totally depends on them being able to pull that off.
Yes.
And you get people like Holly Hunter. You know, Ray Romano, I wouldn't necessarily say is like known for being a terrific actor, but he is better than a lot of people give him credit for.
Yeah, I've always been sort of lukewarm to Ray Romano, personally. Yeah.
I think a lot of people kind of think of the TV show and, like, you know, the sort of easiness of that sort of humor.
But yeah, the Ray Romano voice, you know, it's easy to do. You just, that's Ray Romano, right? Oh.
Deborah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, if this kind of role, he does come from the world of stand-up, and I think that he understands this stuff. And I think that, you know, working with Holly Hunter, who, you know, Holly Hunter, she's like up there with like Laura Dern for me, is just like a total reliable actress who, you know, is going to come in and just elevate the entire thing.
One of my favorite things about like Ray Romano was they kept setting him up for these sort of insightful moments that you get some from romantic comedies traditionally, but his character always sort of falls short of them. Like, even the other characters sort of expect him to sort of say the right thing, and then he'll just say something like a goofy fucking dad would say.
Right. And he in fact says the wrong thing. There's a lot. That's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. It's like there's a lot of places in the movie where it could lean on tradition of the genre. It could become a Nancy Meyer thing.
Yeah.
It could become, you know, one of those kind of syrupy things where it's everybody, like, comes together. There's, you know, a few moments towards the end where the Nancy Meyer music could swell up and you could have the great declaration of love and all of this thing, but those scenes don't even go where you think they're going to go. So
yeah, the movie and
is that, really that was, smart about avoiding cliche.
Especially at, near the ending. I don't want to give away too much, but it doesn't sort of have the typical cathartic Hollywood ending that you would expect.
Yeah.
And that isn't to say it's not, again, I don't want to give away too much. It's not a bad ending. Obviously this is based off his real life marriage.
Right.
But
so you kind of know where it's going.
Yeah. But, you know, if you don't know anything about him as a person, you know, or her, then maybe not, but it's still, right. I like how they play that moment out.
The end. I mean, the ending, like literally, you know, like the literal last scene.
Yeah,
it's one of my favorite last scenes of the year.
Yeah,
like that. That was the. That's what sealed the deal for me. I was kind of on the fence with a lot of stuff. I mean, I liked it, but and accumulatively, when I saw that ending, that's when it all came together to me. That was what the. That's what tied it all up, and I was like, yes, okay, now I see what it was all leading up to. Now I see that there was a direction to all this. Because I do think you said the movie meanders a little. I think it meanders a pretty decent amount. And there's some, specifically, the Ray Romano, Holly Hunter thing. They complicate that sometimes in ways that I don't think the movie needs. I don't want to get into it, but there's, you learn things about the characters that I'm just like, that's a little too over there. I want to be over here.
I kind of get that, but I was just enjoying it so much. I just really liked this movie. I thought it was genuinely very funny, without being pandering or gross, which sometimes Judd Apatow does get kind of unnecessarily. And I know he didn't direct it or, but I think he helped write it.
It has his, fingerprints on it for sure.
Yeah. Like it feels like a Judd Apatow movie, but it doesn't push things unnecessarily. Like it just feels honest to the story, right, which ultimately is what I think this movie needed to be. And I think it ended in sort of a delightful, romantic comedy that you don't get to see a lot of.
There's also some other good, side performances. I thought Bo Burnham was really funny in this, and he's not a person I necessarily always find funny. Okay. I thought he had a little small part in Funny People as well, and this movie in a lot of ways reminded me of Funny People, structurally especially.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is better. But I really like Bo Burnham in this. He played kind of like a lovable douchebag.
I liked all of his friends. I liked Bo Burnham. I liked Eddie Bryant. I loved Kurt Braunohler just because he reminded me of Steve so much.
I wanted a little bit more from that character. I'm not going to lie. Like, given how big of a part of Kumail's life he apparently is and that they live together, they know each other well enough that he's in Kumail's little one-man show. You know, for this big moment of his life, he's not there a lot.
I'm telling you, that was like the exact relationship I had with Steve. Maybe I'm viewing it from a different lens as you.
Maybe.
But to me, it was like, oh, okay, that's my buddy Steve. Like, it just, again, it just felt really honest. Like he didn't need to be in the movie more because there was a much more complex relationship going on with Kumail and his parents. And I would have been annoyed had they kind of spent too much time with Kurt Braunohler. You know, like, I felt like there was just enough of the friends.
Yeah, no. I wouldn't have wanted them to come in and distract or muddle up the plot. I just meant, like, sometimes when he's... And it has a little bit to do with what I would call the second big risk of the movie, which is Kumail purposely writes himself as a very passive character. He's sort of just waiting... He's sort of just sort of a tourist through his own life, through much of the film, and is sort of taking everything at stride... and trying to sort of fit into whatever situation he has to be in as well as he can, given who he is and where he's come from and who his parents are and all of these people. Everyone around him are these bigger personalities.
Yes.
And that pays off. It's really hard to have a movie about a person that passive, but that pays off because it is sort of a coming of age movie. I mean, not sort of, it's very much a coming of age movie. And that larger character arc really kind of sneaks up on you by the end of the movie. And I think it's really nice to see, towards the last third of the movie when I think the magic of this movie really is in the last third for me. I was in it and I was following it, but for me, it really comes together and really like works when all of those threads finally meet.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, yeah. It would have felt like, okay, there's this one movie about his comedy life. There's this one movie about him being really worried about his girlfriend. There's this one movie about these parents. It kind of does have a little bit of a loose structure that could be problematic, but it really gracefully comes together.
I agree completely. I think it was a big plus for me. Also, just the scene where the parents go to the comedy club is so good.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed that a lot.
It's kind of, yeah, the lead up to it and then the scene itself. It's kind of a shticky moment more so than other parts in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's sort of important. It's a place in their relationship that definitely needs to happen.
That's what I mean, though. I think there's just enough, like, genuine comedy setups without feeling too forced. Like, I think the movie pulls back from sort of the forceful, broader comedy potential in a lot of smart ways. But we still get enough of it to where it's still a very funny movie.
For sure. Yeah, I definitely recommend it. If you're able to see it in your city, if it's still playing out there, or if you can get on VOD or something like that, I recommend it.
Yeah, especially a smaller indie movie like this. Like, it's good to support these type of films while they're still in theaters. So,
yep.
Letter grade time.
B, maybe B? B+. Yeah.
Oh, all right. I see. I'd give it an A-.
Okay. I liked it a lot.
I did too. Moving on.
All right, let's get into the Netflix homework, which I had you watch. And somehow you'd never seen before, or never even really knew the plot details of, which really surprised me. Because I
have seen a lot of parody of it.
Exactly.
Which I realized, you know, sort of as I was watching it.
Mm-hmm. But you're like, oh, that's what that's from.
But a lot of them were out of context. Mm-hmm. So I did not know what was coming, genuinely. Like, I would know certain quotes and things like that, but I didn't know the larger picture of sort of what the movie's really about.
Right, right. The movie we're talking about is 1950s Sunset Boulevard. This is co-written and directed by Billy Wilder, who's a famous classic Hollywood director, also directed Some Like It Hot, The Apartment, Double Indemnity, Ace in the Hole. And this movie takes place in Hollywood, in the classic Hollywood era, and it's about a kind of struggling writer named Joe Gillis, played by William Holden, who's trying to avoid debt collectors and trying to get his car from getting repossessed while he's trying to find writing work and running away from debt collectors in the middle of Hollywood on Sunset Boulevard. He pulls into an old decrepit mansion and where he finds Gloria Swanson playing an aged silent film actress named Norma Desmond, who's been basically living as a hermit for the last 30 or so years since her heyday in Hollywood. She lives by herself with her butler named Max von Merling, played by Eric von Stroheim. And he kind of gets caught up in this crazy world where she wants to resurrect her career. She's written this vanity project for herself for her big comeback, whenever that's supposed to happen. and it's a, you know, a totally deranged mess, but he's going to get paid to do it, and she kind of lets him or makes him stay with her, and it's a strange movie. And, you know, the way I describe this, I think you had said something like, well, you'd seen a lot of film noirs at the point in time. This is kind of a film noir, but kind of not. It's kind of a gothic horror film, but kind of not. It's kind of a comedy or satire, but kind of not. And it's definitely, really ahead of its time as far as its intertextual meta-ness about the Hollywood system and sort of its critique of, you know, the rise and fall story and films, of its ilk, as well as the intertextual stuff about the actual actors in the film itself and how some of this stuff plays out. Having never seen it before, what did you think of Sunset Boulevard?
Well, if anyone was watching my live tweets,
yeah, I read the live tweets.
Yeah, finally live tweeted it. This movie was weird.
Sure. Yeah.
It's like a bonkers movie. You know, I do think it's a little dated, and I do think it's a little all over the place, but you know, it's a lot of fun. Man though, Gloria Swanson, I don't think you can really talk about this movie without talking about how fucking great she is in this movie,
right?
Just vamping it up like crazy. To me, that's when the movie starts, is when she comes into it, because,
well, sure, yeah,
she is so captivating. If anyone hasn't seen this, but they've seen Clue, think of like kind of like Madeline Kahn's character from Clue, but taken like totally seriously. So
she's the queen of the prima donnas.
Yes. Yeah. And she has some great one-liners. Yeah.
She's been giving drag queens, you know, quotes for years.
For sure. I do think it's my biggest problem with this movie is sort of the era it comes from. I do think it's a little dated. Like, it has some of those sort of long, boring stretches that movies from this era have a tendency to have, that are a little unnecessarily long. And like his whole setup with the debt collectors, I thought was a little on the contrived side. I feel like that bit could have been tightened a little, and then later he doesn't even care about that so much. So I do think the story is a little all over the place. Especially when it gets to the sort of love triangle aspect. I think that, I don't know, that felt a little weird to me.
I mean, it feels weird. I think it's supposed to, though. The movie, I mean, it's played in a very 1950s sort of fashion. You have to write in between the lines. This is still well within the code and that kind of stuff.
Yes. Yeah. And that's what I mean when I say my problems with it were sort of those things of that era.
But I think if you look at the nuts and bolts of the story of what's actually going on here, what they can't say,
yes,
it's a pretty twisted stuff.
Oh yeah, for sure. I definitely appreciated all of that. I mean, a good portion of this movie I thought was basically a comedy. Like, there's a lot of really funny stuff in this.
Sure, yeah.
I'm not crazy about remakes. I'm not even suggesting they remake this, because I do know it's sort of a Hollywood classic, and that's a bit sacrilegious. That's, you know, sort of like remaking Casablanca. But if they did, I think it would be fun if they just went for like a total comedy.
I haven't seen it. Has been made into a Broadway musical.
And
for a long time, Glenn Close was playing the Norma Desmond role.
Actually doing it in San Diego right now. The secretary at my work is in it. I think she's one of the chorus members, which I did not realize until like I had just watched it. So it's kind of ironic.
That is. So I don't know what the take is for the musical. They might lean more into the dark black comedy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the campiness and that kind of stuff. That might be more where the musical goes. I think it's kind of funny. I saw an old interview with Martin Scorsese when he's talking about the film. And he said when he was a kid watching it, because he was alive when it came out, and he was a child, he thought it was a horror film. You know, the movie opens with, you know that the main character dies.
Mm-hmm.
The movie's told posthumously, I guess. He's speaking from beyond the grave, which has influenced a ton of movies. I mean, up to American Beauty.
Yeah.
And then... and that shot with him like face down in the pool, that's like one of those like copied like shots you see.
Well, that was another thing I was gonna say about it is there are certain shots that are like breathtaking, especially the ending when she descends the staircase is like so well done, and I felt like I wanted some more of those moments.
Well, I think Billy Wilder does. You know, this is kind of a tourist. Certainly, those theories were being bounted about in, like, France or whatever. But there weren't, like, these Tarantino types that existed exactly yet who came at it at, well, what's my cinematic language? These people were really just serving the story. They're working for the studio. But I think you do see these moments of flair and style. And it's very knowing moments because the whole movie is sort of winking back at you. There's this moment, I would think, I've said this a lot lately in the podcast, but the centerpiece of the movie, where Gloria Swanson, Norma Desmond, is and everybody goes to the Paramount lot to meet Cecil B. DeMille, who's making a movie, and she's waiting for their next big project, which is never going to happen. And all of a sudden, you know, she notices some people while she's sitting there on the lot, and... the guy who, you know, the old grip or lighting man who she used to know, like, puts the spotlight on her. And there's this big kind of glorious moment for her where she ascends and she becomes the star that she thinks she is or thinks she still is. And there's a lot of style in that moment as well.
That's what I mean. There's a few moments like that.
I think he.
Wait, what were you saying about.
Martin Scorsese thinking a horror film? Well, you know. When they introduce Gloria Swanson's character, they introduce her like Dracula, essentially. I mean, that's all very gothic horror.
Yeah, and but she's burying a dead monkey. Like,
I know, exactly. She's burying a dead monkey. That's pretty, which you don't even know the whole story of. They don't really go into that all that much.
No, they don't at all.
It's just, and it's also very, it's obviously sort of that thing where you say the thing that's going to happen later.
Foreshadowing.
Foreshadowing of the William Holden character, that this place is a place where, you know, you're not going to escape. There's a lot of little subtle like horror movie tropes that are going on here. Of course, obviously the voiceover and everything and the crime element of it is all very noir, and there's a lot of like chiaroscuro sort of shadowing and that kind of stuff.
Yes, there was a lot less film noir than I expected, though. And I think that's what
less so than like Double Indemnity. Sure.
Yeah.
We're just like stepping out of that era in 1950. I mean, there's plenty of noirs that were being made in the 50s, but at this point, the genre is really sort of splintering and fracturing and doing other things.
And maybe that's why I thought the humor caught me off guard is because it wasn't there was some of that sort of dry film noir humor, but usually the humor in film noir is very like I said, dry. It's usually like and then they hit me with a ton of bricks, you know, and
right tough stuff.
And in this there wasn't really a lot of that at all, so that definitely caught me off guard, but I think it made me enjoy the movie probably a little bit more.
Billy Wilder made film noirs, but he also made The Apartment and Some Like It Hot.
Yeah.
You know, very classic comedies.
I will say it was very unpredictable. Mm-hmm. And I liked that. You know, especially for such a old famous movie, I really, you know, didn't know what was going to happen. But again, that being said, I do think there is some stuff that's pretty dated. I didn't really buy the romance between, Joe Gillis and Betty.
I don't know. I was just about to say she's kind of a writing device in the movie, but the movie is so meta and the movie is so aware of, you know, there's a moment where he and her are kind of banting back and forth about like what this screenplay that they're working on together. Mm-hmm. And, she says something about the, you know, well, psychopaths never go out of style. And obviously we're watching a movie about a psychopath.
Yeah. So, but then they end up writing.
That she's a screenwriter or a reader. And then she herself is kind of a writing device might be intentional.
No, I get that. It just never totally added up to me. And I don't know if you know what I mean? It felt like maybe her element of the story was injected a little too late into the movie for me, because at this point I was like, okay, I thought this was going to be sort of about him escaping or whatever. And then it turns to him.
I think her function in the plot, you know, other than being sort of a Susie Q, like, you know, all American girl, who obviously sort of, juxtaposes against the crazy wackadoo, you know, everythingness mm-hmm. of Norma Desmond, is that she sort of represents his old life. She represents what he moved away from, what he sort of sold his soul to.
Yeah,
to
I get that. Have. And at a certain point, he's turning back to that, and that's, you know, ultimately his demise. It just never quite completely clicked for me, if that makes sense.
I'm not saying the romance itself, like as it plays on screen, is super convincing. I'm not so certain the movie's terribly concerned about that. Maybe it should be a little bit more, but this is also sort of.
I also don't think it necessarily needed to be, because what was important to me about their relationship was about
the creativity,
how Norma Desmond felt about their relationship. Like mm-hmm. the jealousy she felt to me, I think might have been more powerful if it had been completely unfounded. But the fact that it does kind of turn into a real, you know, sort of love affair, I think that's what lost me, was how became a real romance. And I didn't need that. Like, I think it would have been enough for him to flirt with this old life and for her to just get jealous of that. Like, I think that might have spoken to sort of her craziness a little more even. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean. It never quite added up to me. But, you know, a lot of times these movies from this era don't totally add up for me. Like, you know, a lot of them I'm like, oh yeah, I totally see what they're going for. But it's too dated or whatever. And for the most part, I think this held up, pretty well. Mm-hmm. Like I was genuinely entertained by it and, you know, the gripes I did have were, I do think some scenes were a little too long. You know, things like that are very sort of 50s.
Yeah, well, you know, I've talked about this before on the podcast with Richard and when we've talked about other older movies or whatever. Movies just moved different at a point in time.
Yes. You know,
and that has a lot to do with just, like, trends in editing or trends in the, you know, the influence of TV on film and vice versa. And I think that if you look at films made before, say, Star Wars or something like that, movies just had a different pace.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that that's necessarily bad pacing. It's just like, it's just the sort of the pace that everybody was living at was different then. And
yeah,
I think that's reflected in the filmmaking. And I think that, you know, movies at during the classic Hollywood period were a little bit more concerned with sort of filling in the everyday sort of mundane existence of everybody. And that reflects more in the actual film, where you have scenes that wouldn't exist in films today. I actually think that this film, given that, has less of that than most. I think this movie is pretty lean. Yes. I mean, it's 2 hours, but I'm invested enough in this crazy melodrama, that I never feel like the movie steps away from that too much.
I would agree with that. And especially, if we compare it to, say the Billy Wilder movie that I know, Double Indemnity, I feel like this is a lot more spry than Double Indemnity is, which gets so concerned with sort of the contrivance of the indemnity laws, that it has a few more slower moments. Again, I like that movie a lot too.
This movie is a lot more playful than Double Indemnity. Double Indemnity is pretty much a straight thriller.
Yes.
This is, like I said, this is a kind of a hybrid movie. This is actually one of my favorite eras of the noir genre, or just in general genre filmmaking. Cause you had all these weird movies. You had The Furies, which is a really bizarre, like noir, Greek tragedy almost kind of thing at the same time. Then you have Night at the Hunter, which is like a sort of a horror film. It's sort of a fairy tale. It's really bizarre. Yeah.
That's a weird movie, but it's also good. No, I agree. And honestly, not to talk about the editing too much, but I think there's a trend right now for like way too quick of cuts.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've gone totally the opposite, where we can't even, you know, if we just look at the Suicide Squad as a really bad example, you know, we can't even let movies. It feels like, especially in big sort of blockbuster movies, they can't even take moments to breathe. So any kind of blockbuster movie that has just sort of a slower moment is more likely to win me over.
Also, you know, going into sort of the craziness of just like the intertextuality, you know, you can read all the stuff about this movie. There's plenty that's been written, but
yeah,
Gloria Swanson having actually been a silent film star. There's a scene in the movie where
she shows
her own movies. Those are actually movies that she was in. Buster Keaton is actually at the table when they're doing the when she's hanging out and playing cards with her old silent movie friends. That's actually Cecil B. DeMille in playing himself in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And Eric von Stroheim was a famous Hollywood director who directed her. I think that film they show in the movie is one that he directed with her.
Yeah, I thought that all of that stuff also totally worked for me, and I thought was really like cool. And I was curious if that was actually Cecil B. DeMille or you know what I so I think, you know, the meta-ness of it, the intertextuality of it is one of the coolest things about this movie. And like you said, right then, that's very ahead of its time.
And the critique on the Hollywood, sort of the Hollywood promise, the false Hollywood promise, and
especially towards women. Mm. Yeah.
Well, this is one of the biggest influences on, David Lynch's Mulholland Drive, up to the point of, you know, naming the movie after a famous Hollywood road. And the main apartment set on Mulholland Drive, where most of the action takes place, is on Sunset Boulevard. One of my favorite movies. I could go on about it forever. I think everyone should see it. I think, given that it's a film from 1950, it's fascinating and entertaining and totally bizarre.
I was not prepared for how weird and goofy and fun it was.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, this is pretty fun romp.
Yeah, totally bizarre. And what did you have for me next week?
Next week, we're going to watch another beloved classic by many, but neither of us have seen, the animated feature from 1996, The Iron Giant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But somehow we both missed, which is really bizarre.
Yeah, I feel like, oh, it's 1999, not 1996.
I know the character is going to have kind of a comeback in the Steven Spielberg thing.
Yeah, apparently the Iron Giant is in... Yeah, at Comic-Con, he said the Iron Giant plays a larger part than you might guess. Mm-hmm. He had a very small reference in the book. Yeah.
Cool. Well, that's the episode. And if anybody has anything to say about anything we talked about on this episode... you can email us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find the show and download it at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com is where our RSS feed and our main archives are, but we're also available on Google Play, player.fm, Stitcher Radio, Pocket Cast, and the Windows Podcast Network. You can follow the show on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. You can also follow us on Twitter at jabberpodcast. And you can find me at BC Cassidy with the V as in Victor. Where do they find you?
Do you think it's weird that we call podcast shows?
Kind of. I mean, they're shows. They're a little minor production.
No. I mean, it's just like the term show. It comes from showing people things, but literally, by definition, podcasts, shouldn't they just be called listens? Anyway, if you want vague philosophical musings and sometimes jokes like that, you can follow me at Keith Foster Kid on Twitter, at Keith Foster Kid on Instagram. Go to my website, www.keithfosterkid.com, to check out, like, my latest shows. I have a calendar there. I have a contact page, all that good stuff. There is a show, I believe it's on Monday, August 21st. Mm-hmm. One of the interns is leaving our show tonight in San Diego, which is on hiatus, but you should follow that on all the things as well. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. But anyway, one of our interns is leaving. She's going to film school in Chicago. She's going to Harold Ramis Film School.
Okay.
And so she's having a going away party that's also a fundraiser to help her pay for said school. And there's going to be a bunch of people doing comedy. I am one of those people. It should be a fun time. August 21st at, Winston's in Ocean Beach. I believe it's listed from 5 p.m. to 8:30. So, if you want to get your drink on a Monday, or just, hang out and have a good time, it should be fun.
Cool. We have friends who do podcasts. You should be listening to them as well. Rod Denise at The Listening Party, Denise at Mascot Diaries, and Patrick and Dennis at Almost Educational, and Patrick and his father at Make Dad Read Comics. Also, Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums podcast. I don't talk about them as much, but I was on their show a long time ago, and they're really coming up in the world of podcasts, and they're going to be famous very soon.
Yeah, also check out, I think it's Blizzlet.com.
We'll get this down eventually.
You know what? They need to fucking update it on Player FM if they really want me to pay attention. Fuck iTunes.
I use iTunes, but I suppose you probably can't with your phone.
No, I have an Android, which I upgraded from an Android or from a Windows phone to an Android. Mm-hmm. Surprisingly, Windows phone has way better autocorrect.
Mm.
Sort of drives me nuts.
Good autocorrect is an oxymoron.
No, Windows Phone had a really good one. Unfortunately, they had no good apps or high-performing operating system, so autocorrect isn't going to save it.
Okay, that's the show.
And like always, give it to Gosling.
Bye.